Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week this show will address many ways of creating greater health, joy, and love for you and those you care about. We're going to introduce you to top professionals and talented authors who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, I'd really appreciate it if you would all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows, or many of them if you've got the time, to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is just one powerful way we can make a positive difference together. Now, I want all of you to know that I am grateful that you take your time to listen to or watch this show, and especially those that send in questions, comments, reviews, and suggestions. Because please remember, this show exists for you. Now, I was told that I haven't mentioned this in a while, so here it goes. If you haven't gotten your free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal yet, please go to our website at answers.network and download a copy. Give it 21 days and comment on whatever platform you listen to us on, what focusing on gratitude has meant for you and your loved ones. And if you'd like to send them to us, and you can do it via our website, I'll read some of them on the air. And with us coming up on Thanksgiving, I think this is the perfect time to do that. Now, as many of you who know me or have listened to the show for quite some time, I believe that one of the best ways for us to make a positive difference in the world is to focus on love, gratitude, and finding your own path to making a difference in the lives of others. Well, our guest today is certainly doing that. Now, I also want to share that we get a lot of questions, many of which they'll come directly for a particular guest, and sometimes they just come to me, and I don't always think that I'm the expert. But one question that we've gotten many times, it has to do with finding greater health and happiness. Now, some of which have addressed their struggles with drugs or alcohol. One of these questions seemed to resonate the thoughts and feelings of many people struggling to make a better life for themselves and their loved ones. So Jessica from Madison, Wisconsin wrote, "I feel like I'm in a constant state of the hurrier I go, the behinder I get. Years ago, I started using coffee and energy drinks to get through my day. When that wasn't enough, I began using methamphetamines. What followed was depression and anxiety. And after detoxing from that, I felt less anxious, but I was still having bouts with depression. Could you bring on a guest that can talk about this or direct me to a past show that addresses this? All I want is to live a happy, healthy life." Well, Jessica, our guest today, Bob Gardner, is the founder of The Freedom Specialist, a body-based approach to happiness, health, and well-being. Bob is also the author of the book Built for Freedom, and he is the host of the podcast Alive and Free. Now, as a transformational specialist, Bob's aim is to share his unique tools with the world that help them find happiness, health, and well-being, and doing it on autopilot. Now, after 18 years of being trapped in addictive patterns, and on the brink of both divorce and suicide, something inside of him said it was time, but yet not to quit. So Bob chose to create a way to permanently eliminate the addictive patterns from his life. And his body-based, no-nonsense approach to freedom has since helped thousands of people leave their struggles behind and find real freedom and happiness. In addition, Bob's intensive retreats, transformational coaching, and online resources have supported people struggling with everything from chronic pain, anxiety, depression, PTSD, childhood wounds, addictions, and OCD, so they can take their life back and begin to thrive again. Well, I think that we have come up with the person that that can answer her question best. And I just want to add that for the past 15 years, Bob's been incorporating multiple tools and knowledge gained from his years of martial arts, breath work, functional psychology, deep tissue release, and numerous other healing modalities to help thousands of people permanently put an end to depression, anxiety, and addiction by identifying and healing what's at the core of their issues. Bob, welcome to Answers Network.
Hey, thanks for the welcome. I didn't expect to sit here for the entire introduction.
I'm glad you did, because again, as I said off the air, I was so impressed when I started looking into what you've been doing, and in your history as well. I think that this is a message that tells people that whatever it is that you're going through, not only can you get through it, but here's somebody who went through it, figured out what works, and is now trying to give back and share it with other people. And I don't think it gets much better than that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to learn from books. It's definitely something else to see that somebody else has done it and go, wait a second, it's not just a theory anymore. Let me get some of that.
Well, definitely. And one of the things that I loved the most was the connection between freedom and happiness. How did you come to make this connection?
It's a great question. Desperation is really kind of what drove most of my discoveries. I had struggled with addictive behaviors and like manic depressive swings, like, and then bipolar shifts up into this mm-hmm. huge, like, I'm high on life and then I'm down in the trough again. I had been suicidal for a long time, and I was just sort of managing it. I was doing well. Like, on the outside, people would have thought I was just charismatic and having a bad day or something like that. But my internal experience of life was one that was just, it felt like a burden. It felt like there was nothing I could ever do fully right. And I, at a certain point, was in the middle of that struggle when my wife left home for a bit to go pick up the children. And in that moment, my whole body armed itself to be like, now's my chance. Let me go join into all of my compulsive behaviors again. I've got time. No one's going to know. And like, in that moment, when my feet are rooted to the carpet and my hands are shaking and there's cold washes of chemistry running through my brain, and I've got this tunnel vision going on, I had this sort of out-of-body experience that was like seeing myself as a 90-year-old still in the middle of that same struggle and going, I can't do it. I don't want to die, but I don't want that life. Mm-hmm. And so that was the moment that I kind of threw out all of the conventional wisdom, all of the things that I had been taught, all the programs I had been to, and I was like, look, I've learned a lot of great things, but it hasn't obviously helped me get to the place that I want to be. And where I wanted to be wasn't, oh, I'm managing this and I'm coping with it well and I have this diagnosis for life. Where I wanted to be was a kind of total freedom on autopilot, so that all of my mental energy could be focused on living the life I wanted and not on keeping the dogs at bay.
I love the connection to freedom, and we're freeing ourselves, or what I get from it is we're freeing ourselves from addictions, compulsions, cravings, whatever we want to call them. But you mentioned something about what people saw, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, because I think that there's a lot of people that don't realize they may very well know somebody and they think they're the most charismatic person because they only see what you choose to put out there, and they don't see what's going on. And just like you just said, once you were alone, once nobody else was around, these things came in. Share a little bit about that, because again, I think people are, you know, they don't realize that somebody they may think is, you know, greatest person in the world and that never has any problems may very well have some, and they just don't see it.
Yeah, I used to sit in these 12-step programs for years, first as a participant and then as a facilitator. And the common phrase was, we're high-functioning addicts, you know, meaning like, well, nobody would really know that we were addicts. And because you would see a person, like I was running a martial arts school. I had, at the time, 4 children. I have 6 children now. And they're of varying ages and whatnot. And so I'm playing with them and I'm engaging with them and I'm joking around with them. I have a little bit of a charismatic nature to me. So people would be kind of confused by, oh, that guy, he seems like he's so vibrant. So he must have it all together. My wife and I were like, we loved each other. We're careful with each other, even though I was still struggling on the inside. And some of it was with like sexual type addiction and pornographic usage. And so we were struggling with, hey, like, we still are committed. And yet this dude has the problem that makes her feel like he's stepping out on her, even though he's trying to just manage his emotional states and doesn't see it that way. And so there's all this negotiation at home and a sense of loneliness and alienation in the relationship that was happening. I was comparing myself to my kids, you know, trying, sometimes I was treating them really poorly, or I'd yell at them. Mm-hmm. Or I remember when they were kids, like babies, I would be so frustrated feeling like I couldn't get anything right. And they were screaming at night and I couldn't get them to stop. And I squeezed them. Like, I'm glad none of them died, but like, I'm the guy that everybody thinks, oh wow, this guy's intelligent and articulate and smart on the outside. At home, gets to a place of desperation that out he goes to an addictive behavior, to some substance, to a sexual encounter, to like squeezing his children and whatnot. And all of a sudden you have this weird picture where somebody on the news would be like, I never saw it coming. He was such a good guy. And it's because when you focus only on one tiny detail of a person and you blow that up and magnify that and assume that that's the whole person, you miss so much of what's going on. The same thing in reverse. When you look at your own life, not online, and you go, man, I'm depressed all the time, and you blow that up and assume that's the whole of your life, you also miss the entirety of who you are. And sometimes just getting people to be like, how many minutes in a day are you actually depressed, makes them go like, holy cow, I wasn't depressed for like 12 straight hours. Maybe I'm not depressed. Maybe I only feel depressed at a certain time. You know, just getting honest with that is really critical. And nowadays with social media, it seems a little bit more exacerbated, the amount of public presence and facade people have to put on, where when you look at your children at home, they're putting on a facade for their parents to try and make sure that they're doing things right. Mm-hmm. And to be able to be in a place where they don't feel any threat or any attempt to you to try to fix them, so that they can finally show up and be real and just say what's happening with them, is such a freeing thing, because now something can actually change instead of them constantly having to carry this stuff and keep it hidden.
And you just mentioned about putting on a persona, because essentially it's as if we always have a camera on us, or we always, you know, there's always something paying attention. Along those lines, how much of an effect do you think it is with the amount of negativity that we are bombarded with?
My father-in-law, actually, so if you're familiar with DARE programs in school, he created a NOVA program that's somewhere across some of the Western United States, and it's focusing on more than just drug use. And he pulled in some psychologists and whatnot. And at one point years ago, me and this psychologist were meeting, talking about some things. And the statistics they suggested were like, in order to get, you know, have a positive or at least a somewhat stable view of yourself, you need to have at least 2, maybe 3 to 1 positive to negative feedback. But the average amount of feedback that a person is getting just for their own self in a junior high school is like 17 negative to 1 positive. And you think, and it's innocuous. People are playing and bashing each other, but, you know, and then some of it is, you know, things they see online and cyberbullying. And, you know, my kids have been a victim to a few of these things. And so some of it's really intense, and others of it is just playful, but still the amount of negativity that's there is something that I'm constantly with my own children. Like, I pull them up, I'm like, did you just hear the word that came out of your mouth? You having an okay day, buddy? Because you just called him a name. Like, how are you feeling if you're being this negative? Because what people don't realize is they think that love and gratitude and all of these things are like actions that you do. What I found in my own experience is that love is just a state I'm in. And when I'm in that state, I smear it over everything. And if anger or negativity or self-hatred is a state that I'm in, I smear that over everybody too. And so I have a hard time saying, oh, I love you, when the question is, if I am in love, period, then I love everything. Mm-hmm. And most of these kids are not in love. They are in survival. They are in comparison. They are in time crunch, and I never get what I want. And a lot of times they're in a lot of self-judgment when they don't get a chance to just realize just the beauty of their own life.
And, you know, you just mentioned survival. And actually, I think I had a question specifically in regards to that, because I know that over the last couple of years, you know, it's an answer that I've heard an alarming amount of times, because I was just at a conference and I've been going to some of these conferences and seeing not necessarily the same people, but people within the same professions for 40 years. And so I've seen some of the changes and it's been alarming how many times where I see somebody, oh my God, how are you? You know, and that's my initial thing. And the answer that I've gotten way too many times is surviving. And I'm like, wow, you know, I used to ask this and people would go, well, I'm doing great. And let me tell you about my children, or let me tell you about my grandchildren, or let me tell you about, I just fell in love. You know, there was so many great things. And it seems that if I had to narrow it down, you know, what's one answer that seems to be coming up more often than any other? It's surviving. Mm-hmm. So how can somebody move from survival or survivor to thriver?
Yeah. You know, a lot of the thing, if you look up online, you know, how to do some of this stuff, you'll see, I don't know how many millions of Google results that show up when they're asking how to get past this sense of survival mentality. And one of the things that I found was that there's too much emphasis placed on the mind, on having to think through problems and solve problems and keep things under control and see how things are going, have a plan, all of the other stuff. And while that's a beautiful skill, it is a part of being human and we don't want to neglect it. It is heavily overemphasized with regard to anxiety, depression, addiction, childhood wounds or past traumas, PTSD, all of these other kind of mood swings. When you're looking at what's going on, the biggest thing to recognize is your brain, the producer of your experience, the director of the show, the Steven Spielberg of your life, your mm-hmm. brain is not in touch with the outside world. Unless you're in brain surgery right now, at which point, if you're right. watching the show, that's a lot.
Yeah.
It's not touching the outside world. So the only way that it gets to see what's going on is through the lens of your body, your senses, your fingers, your eyeballs, your nose, your tongue, your mouth, your teeth, all of these sensations that are going in and through you, the five main human senses on top of the internal senses like proprioception, interoception, your electromagnetic sense of place in the world, your sense of balance, all of these things, temperature shifts. All that information is coming up through the brain all the time. And then the outside world, your circumstances, are coming through that field of meteors mm-hmm. to get to your brain. So what you can see of the outside world and how beautiful life is like looking through a mud-splattered windshield. You're just sitting there going like, I think life is okay, but all you can see is the mud. And so what I started to focus on was how do I clear the mud out of the body? How do I get it to a place of such ease that it feels beautiful just to be in my own skin, regardless of what the outside circumstances are doing? Because those are happening anyway, so I might as well be able to enjoy it. Yeah.
Well, what I was going to say is, so let's use this mud. Because I know in the book you write about root causes. Mm-hmm. So is this mud one of the root causes? You know, what do you believe is the root cause, for instance, of trauma, and regardless if it came from childhood or adulthood?
Yeah. So let's look at trauma as a word. This is one of the things that I had to challenge for myself in a big way, because it is bandied about as if it's like this big thing. Do you have trauma? Do you not have trauma? Same with addiction, same with depression. When I really started to look, I had to get honest with myself and realize that there is no such thing as trauma, that wow. It's not a molecule that's running around. There's nothing in the body. No one's ever cut open a cadaver and be like, oh, dude, I found a trauma. So I'm going, what is this thing? Same with addiction. There's no such thing. No lab on the planet has ever found one. And the same with depression, anxiety. There are, however, there's stuff going on the inside. And these words are labels that we've placed on the jar of our experience. It's hard to see inside the jar with a big fat label on it. So if we ripped the label off, the trauma label and all this other stuff, and we go, what's really going on? Then you'll see muscle tensions. You'll see body chemistry. You'll see postural shifts. You'll see the way a person breathes. You'll see how they move. And you'll see that those connect to the times, like when they're doing this, then their thoughts and their feelings start to have a certain character. And when they're doing a different thing, then their thoughts and feelings have a certain character. And I started to realize that I used to think that the root issue was a belief I had about myself. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I was helping people dismantle those beliefs in some really profound ways by seeing through them. And it was great. But what I realized was that those beliefs are built on the way that my body is interacting with its environment. When the body changes, it's like having a Lego set with like Voldemort and, you know, a basilisk at the bottom of the castle and people are dying and there's threats of a dark order coming. And then if you change the Lego set, give them Bob the Builder as an extreme shift, suddenly they can't build a Hogwarts castle anymore because they don't have the tools for it. I'm trying to change the Lego set from this mud-splattered windshield to this glorious windscreen that's clear and bright and easy, keeps the bugs off, all these other things, and so that my experience of life can be seamless and with a lot of ease. So the root issue that I would talk about, one, is a belief that people have typically, but that belief is built on the way that they react to the world, their body's learned habit of reacting, what I would call an instinct. Those instincts are what I went about trying to learn how to retrain. And when you do that, then all of the beliefs start to go away on their own and you don't have to sit there and like, you know, do affirmations for yourself, believing that you're strong and all that. Not that those aren't helpful, right, but you don't have to do it when your body no longer behaves as if you are.
So to kind of mirror this back, so to start off with, it sounds like what you're saying is that these body functions are now indicators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That be, you know, so it's more of an indicator of stress or anxiety, but we're going after the indicators that are going to now work to resolve the stress and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm following.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I like that.
If like I would have people who, for instance, some of the people that would come to me were dealing with a sexual addiction. They would talk about it because they've been to Sexaholics Anonymous. All the talk there is that lust is the main thing and that they're actually addicted to lust, not to sex. They've sort of shifted the focus. And so I would look at them and I would say, okay, cool. You're lusting. Show me what it looks like for you to lust. And they assume a position all the time. They breathe a certain way. Their head is cocked a certain way. If we turn them upside down on their head, rolled over a ball, and I was like, okay, I want you to lust from this position, it would be really difficult for them to do it because their body isn't used to doing lust that way. And right. So you start to break up. Oh, cool. Well, you're feeling this way. I'm feeling anxious. I'm walking around. I've got this pit. I'm jittery movement. Start to change your movement. Start to change your breathing. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be big, deep breaths. You can hold your breath. Just change it consciously. And all of a sudden, you're in control of the very thing that you thought was controlling you.
Okay. Well, let's take lust. Mm-hmm. I like this topic.
Are you lustful of this topic?
So I would imagine that there is good lust and not so good lust. You know, lusting one's husband, wife, significant other seems like that's a really good thing, as opposed to, you know, lusting everybody that's walking down the street. Break down where it's a positive and where it becomes more negative or distressing.
You know, all of that depends on what you want out of your life. For instance, I don't really appreciate the experience of lust when I look at it from the standpoint of my body. My body is not interested in experiencing lust because that's a massive energetic shift in the body. Like it demands energy to do it. Mm-hmm. And it creates tension in the body, which puts stress on the internal organs, and it creates so much noise neurologically that now I'm not sensitive to my environment. So from a survival standpoint, lust is not ideal for the body ever.
Okay. Well, so what does your wife think of this?
Right. Of my wife think of this? We don't talk in terms of lust at all.
Okay.
We're just like, it's a fluid relationship. But I'm just saying in terms of the body. So if like, if you're looking for my body must never be disturbed, then all lust is going to be seen as something that's negative. But if you're looking at, look, I want to build a relationship with my wife. I want when my wife walks by, I want to feel that draw toward her. I just don't want to feel it toward other people.
Right.
That's great. All of these, what's beautiful about training the body is that you can train it situationally dependent. Like you don't have to always – sit there and be like, all lust is bad, and so I have to be afraid of lust. You can just sit there and be like, no, I really appreciate this one. I'm going to do that. Oh, in these situations, I don't want to do that. So you grab a hold of the stuff if your body starts to respond that way and be like, no, no. And then you start to shift it and turn it around and change it. So there's nothing wrong or right with the amount of lust you want to have. Like if you're a single dude, well, you don't have a – or a single female, since we can be all inclusive. Like you don't have a particular person you want to drive it toward, but you do want to be attracted to the opposite sex and appreciate all that stuff. That's going to be a very different answer than somebody who is in a monogamous relationship.
Gotcha. So let's talk about now – So you're saying rather than use the term trauma, what term would we use when there is something going on with the body? Or and again, it's a term that I'm familiar with, but you know, so I'll use the term for now, and then sure. If there's a different term, we can certainly use it. But. But, you know, so, I mean, there are people that we know that, in fact, it's so funny. This conference I was just at, so many of the booths and stuff, you know, behind them. And it said, you know, we have trauma experts, you know, we're going to deal with, you know, your childhood trauma, or we're going to deal with your adult trauma. Or so going with that. If there are people who know or believe that they've been traumatized, but they aren't really able to recall a particular event that triggered it, how do you help people process these events that they can't really recall verbally?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. And what's beautiful about understanding what's really happening is that even if you know something happened, you don't actually have to talk about it in order to be able to resolve it. You don't have to tell the story over and over again, like narrative theory and some of these other psychological theories would have right. You do. You don't have to do that at all, because in the end, what are we talking about? So if you want to talk about trauma, it's some seed idea or response that you've developed to life at a time of intensity, mm-hmm. whether that was repeated moments yeah. of intensity like bullying, or your dad always said the same thing to you every day, or whether it was one big thing like rape or molestation or abuse or an injury, even an injury mm-hmm. or anything like that. And then there's some idea that a person forms about the world in that moment of intensity. But when they're dealing with trauma in any given moment, we have to use language in order to communicate. So I don't think it's bad to use the word trauma. It's just that it has so much baggage to it. So in the book, I make the case for a totally different word that nobody's used. But nobody's using it. So it's hard to refer to it, called angustia, which is just a constriction. When you look at a person who's experiencing trauma, they don't have a trauma all day long. Like they laugh at a joke. In that moment, they're not experiencing trauma. They're experiencing laughter. They're experiencing joy. They're watching Ellen DeGeneres scare her people on YouTube or something. And they're not experiencing trauma. So they don't, in that moment, in their experience, they don't have trauma. What happens is in any given moment, some environmental cue comes in, bing, through the senses. And their body in that moment responds the way that it responded the last time, or the only way that it knows how. Right. And then the brain goes, where have we seen this before? And it goes, I know what this is. And then their brain sends a message to their body, and it reenacts something that isn't happening, which is a trauma. Which is what we call trauma, right? And so now they're doing, oh, I've been triggered. Newsflash, nobody has triggers. We're not guns. We don't have little dangly things. So these metaphors that we use, while they've been useful to a certain extent, they often become a hindrance at a certain point. Mm-hmm. So what you're having when you're dealing with trauma, what you're having is a biological response to an environmental cue.
Okay.
A
biological response to essentially a memory.
Yeah, well, but that memory didn't come up except in response to that cue. Yeah. But yeah, it's to a memory, right? So the memory didn't just surface on its own. They were feeling lonely and then a memory surfaced, or They were feeling stressed and then a memory surfaced. Mm-hmm. So there's some body state that cues the brain to go hunting through its files. And then what they're dealing with is a reenactment. This is where it's beautiful. I don't have to know why I'm traumatized or why I'm stressed, because if I need to know, my brain will produce it for me. But if I'm just like, man, I'm feeling really anxious right now and I don't know why, instead of thinking, oh, I'm feeling really traumatized, just go like, well, what does it mean to feel anxious? Like, is my kneecap feeling anxious? Are my butt cheeks currently freaking out about next week's game or test? What about my nose hairs? No, the anxiety feels like it connects to, I don't know, they're dumb questions, but they're very helpful for you to see that it's not actually swallowing all of you. It's just in a certain spot. And I go, okay, cool. I'm tense here, here, here. Oh, if I, okay, look, my breathing has changed now. Oh, if I breathe differently. So, okay, that feels different. Let me give you a tiny example.
Oh, please do.
One time my website had broken. And so I'm in the room and all of my youth training of like, you have to provide for your family is now on the table. I'm never going to get money again. Like no one's ever going to, we're not, my family's going to starve. We're never going to have a place to live. We're going to be home. I'm in that trying to fix the website and I'm feeling anxiety build. And I didn't realize that it was happening at the moment. And then my wife walked in and she's like, hey, my brother's on the phone. He wants to know if you want to go fishing with the kids this weekend. Now, in that moment, my brain was like, bah! Woman, I never get time to myself. I'm trying to save the family from this dire disaster.
And you're talking about fishing.
Yeah, and you want me to go fishing? And in times past, I would have gone, fine, sure, whatever, and then like let her go. And then I would have seethed about it for weeks, resenting her for interrupting me, resenting all of this extra responsibility I have. Instead, in her question made me realize like, holy cow, I'm in a dire straits. So what did I do? Inside of my brain, at least, I narrated, wow, I am not feeling great. I need to change up the biology. So I hit the floor and I started doing snow angels on the carpet, big breaths. Mm-hmm. She looks down at me. She goes, are you okay? You need me to like hit you in the chest or something? I was like, no. And then I started narrating to her. No, it's just that my website was broken. I started to feel a lot of anxiety. I didn't realize it was happening. You came in and asked this question. And I don't think I'm in a great place to answer this question. Can you give me a couple hours to sort some things out? She goes, sure, and leaves. And then I feel tons better. Then I get up and I handle the website. We still went fishing that weekend. It was a great trip. I had a great time. The difference was, instead of being a victim to an emotion, I realized that the emotion is something being created inside me. Never once in my life has an emotion come from somewhere else on the outside. It's always an inside job. If I get injected with a drug, still it's an inside job that's producing my experience, not an outside job. So I'm sitting there realizing this is internal, and it's my job to take control of this horse instead of just giving it its head and letting it run wherever it wants. So I, you know, took charge of the situation and did snow angels on the carpet. Is that easy to do in a boardroom? No. At the grocery store? Probably not. So there are other ways to do it that are subtler and simpler, but they all involve the same basic process, which is acknowledge what's going on. I call this emotional ninjutsu for people in the book, right? Acknowledge what's going on. Okay, I see clearly what's happening. And I narrate it like nobody's business in my head or out loud, even to my wife. Kids are screaming in the back of the car and I start to get a little anxious. So I start breathing, you know? Mm-hmm. She looks over at me and rolls her eyes. Now my brain goes, what? I'm the one trying to manage my emotion. Why are you rolling your eyes at me, lady? I catch it. I narrated out loud. Wow. Just a second ago, you rolled your eyes. I totally took that like you were getting on my case about being so emotionally unstable. Isn't that amazing? Wow. Just one eye roll. And she looks at me and she goes, no, I was agreeing with you. The kids are a little bit out of control. Mm-hmm. It was the narration that did the trick. If I can narrate it, I can get clear on what I'm feeling. Where in exactly in my body I'm feeling it, now I am set up to actually deal with what's really happening. The past is not happening. The future is not happening. What is happening is breathing, movement, tension, chemistry. Those are what's actually happening and what is the root building blocks of my entire experience. Knowing that, then I can change my breathing. I can loosen up my tension. I can shift up my movement. And I can change my posture to be in a situation where I feel better. But Bob, what if it only lasts for 5 minutes? Then you got 5 minutes of freedom. That's amazing. How about we do it for another 5 minutes and then you get another 5 minutes and pretty soon your body picks it up as a muscle memory and a habit. Just because you've learned misery by like on autopilot, that doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It means your brain is and body are so brilliant. They can pick up a skill so deftly that they can do it without your having to think about it. Consider that. There's nothing wrong with you. Everything is right with you. If you can be miserable, it means that's concrete evidence that you are perfectly formed. It's just that you went to the dojo of misery instead of the dojo of delight. So you're a white belt at happiness on autopilot. We'll get there, but you got to do your reps.
What it sounds like is that the first step. So it sounds like the first step is we've got to stay in the present. Is that right?
Yeah, just honesty. Just being honest with what's there. Wow, this thing just barely showed up.
So stay in the present as your first thing. So the base part of the concept of your body-based approach to happiness and well-being, stay in the present and have an internal dialogue to what's really happening versus where your mind is trying to take it to.
I mean, as long as you can see the difference between external reality and internal thoughts about reality, if you can see that they're not the same, the difference is when we grew up in school, like we train people like that's a tree, so that we start to associate thoughts with things to the point where, like when you were born, nobody, like, you didn't know Alan from any other sound in the playbook, right?
Right.
You were just laying there as some googly-eyed, involuntarily jerking around little baby. You were probably adorable by your mother's standards, no doubt. And the sound Alan didn't really mean much to you. But at a certain point as a baby, that sound became like an indicator that something's going to happen in my environment. Maybe I'll see a big face all of a sudden, or someone's going to pinch my cheeks. And then pretty soon you'd hear Alan. And then you're like, oh, they're talking to me. And now you've associated a sound with you. And then at that point in time, you go to school and they're like, Alan, and you go, that's me. It's not you. It's just a sound. But now because you've made this link between a sound and yourself, or a thought and yourself, now they can hurt the sound and it feels like it's hurting you. They can tickle the sound. They can be like, Alan, and it feels like it's tickling you. Mm-hmm. That confusion between ideas and reality is the place where all this suffering happens. And so when you can separate that and realize, oh, wow, I'm having these thoughts. Oh, and a bird is chirping across the street and the dog's pooping in the yard and the sun is hitting my skin. All right, now we have some freedom to start to play.
All right, folks, we are speaking with Bob Gardner and we are talking about we're talking about happiness. We're talking about wellness. But the interesting thing is we're talking about freedom. Mm-hmm. So stay with us. We're going to be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Conflict International are experts at uncovering the truth. Our specialist team has decades of experience in providing a range of bespoke investigation and intelligence services to companies and individuals. Whether you need professional screening or background checks of employees, due diligence of potential clients or business partners, asset tracing services, or surveillance, Conflict International has a rapid response team on hand to get you to the heart of the matter. Our key strength is in our global capabilities. We can tap into an extensive network of trusted professional investigators based in most jurisdictions worldwide, enabling us to go almost anywhere a case takes us. Conflict International has decades of experience with a diverse range of skills among our team, developed from backgrounds in military and security intelligence services, as well as practiced lawyers. Visit our website today at conflictinternational.com to find out more about our services. That's conflictinternational.com. Global reach, local knowledge.
And we're back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network. We are speaking with Bob Gardner, also known as the Freedom Specialist. So when we went to break, we were talking about the body-based approach to happiness and wellness. So, Bob, how does it differ from other approaches? You mentioned a little bit, there's some that are very just verbal, or where you have people that are going to those traumatic events. And the belief is that if you talk about it enough, it'll somehow diffuse it. Let's talk about the differences.
So one of the major differences that I had to contend with from the beginning is that in the entire industry of therapy and coaching and whatnot, the predominant narrative is that these diagnoses are things that you're just kind of stuck with for life. So we've normalized anxiety. We've normalized depression. Everybody has it. They're facts of life. We've normalized addiction to a certain extent, but you know, people have addictive tendencies and whatnot. Right. We've talked about it as genetic inheritance. So we've shifted blame. And the idea is that we've sort of made room at the table of life for all of these negative factors. And what we can do is we can manage it or cope with it and do so in a positive way that helps us feel like, you know, we've been through hard things. And I wanted to challenge that in a big way.
Good.
Because I was not interested ever, like, in living life to say that stress is a fact of life. Mm-hmm. People will say that, but it is, except when it isn't. So what does that mean?
Right.
And stress, if it's made on the inside of me and I just have a habit of not making stress, then what does that mean about human nature and human life? And so I started to question these basic underpinnings of what the industry was telling me, because I didn't want to be there. I could have called my company the addiction specialist or the anxiety specialist or something like that, but I wanted to focus on the one thing that I wanted my life focused, which was on freedom itself. Mm. So if every time I look at my company name, freedom is what shows up, then my whole focus goes there, and where your focus goes, your life flows. And what entertains you trains you. So here I am going, what can I entertain my nervous system with that produces a habit of happiness on autopilot by instinct without me having to game it? And at first it was just a hypothesis. Right. It was just I don't see anybody else doing this. Even today, there's a lot of practices that consider it unethical to get the client's hope up to consider that they can actually walk away from depression or walk away from anxiety or walk away from ADHD or walk away from addiction. They consider it unethical to tell them that this could be gone for good. But all of this stuff is the only reason it sticks around. One is because we haven't learned how to just fully like process it and let it out. And two, because the narrative in society is that this is how life works. This is human nature. If you've been to an English class, they talk about these great works of literature about human nature, and they're all about suffering humans. You go to a movie, it's all about drama. Nobody wants to go to a movie and watch a guy just sniff flowers all day and feel wonderful. They want to see the guy struggle, because we've enshrined this idea that overcoming struggle is what makes life worth living. And that's fine if you want to live that way. I didn't at all. You know, you can only build a muscle by tearing it down. That's great, except when you consider that a baby comes out of the womb with muscles and it wasn't lifting weights. So how were those muscles built? That's great when you consider that some research has been done on college students, probably because they paid them to pull a spring with their finger. but like for 2 weeks, pulling a spring with their finger to measure increase of muscle mass, 30% increase of muscle mass by exercising the finger. You know what? They had a group just visualized exercising their finger and had a 22% increase in muscle mass. Tell me how that broke the finger down in order to create a new reality. It didn't. So despite the narrative that drama and conflict and stuff is what makes life worth living, when I started to look at the chemical nature of emotion, all of these things we call negative emotions are basically negative because they tear the body down. They poison it by degrees. And it seems like happiness and gratitude and peace and a lot of these things that you have people, you know, develop and you work with, those the chemical traces of those put the body into high gear to where you operate in flow states. Your immune system is stronger. You have more physical strength, more stamina, more interpersonal connectivity. You like everything about the human body seems to thrive on happiness juice.
Yeah.
And yet the narrative is, no, what makes happiness worthwhile is all the suffering so that you can appreciate happiness. And I challenged that.
Good.
So I was sitting there. I'm in my office. I'm on I was in Arizona at the time. And I had been striving, you know, I'm a nerd, okay? Like martial arts. And so from the time I was a kid, all of the animes about like special chi powers and whatnot. And I was like, I want to learn how to do this superhuman stuff. Because I was still trying to prove that I was worth something. And I think it's cool. But like, I was trying to prove that I was worth something. And so in the moment when I was like studying up on some of this stuff, I had this vision where my mind left And I was Superman, but I was like not the old school Superman with the bright blue outfit and stuff. I was like the new angsty version of Superman that doesn't have any friends and doesn't really belong and, you know, is at odds with all the other superheroes. And I realized, man, even if I can walk on all the water in the world and shoot laser beams out of my eyeballs, if I'm unhappy, I will still be super unhappy. And so that was when I changed my superpower. I'm like, if I have one superpower in life, it is to be happy, period.
I like it.
And that, I feel like, is what needed to be challenged a lot.
Well, I want to tell everybody, if you get the opportunity to get the book, because there are so many positive things like this, including some success stories. So can you share a couple of success stories or examples of individuals who have benefited significantly from your freedom specialist approach?
Yeah, sure. So like we've had people in the book. I mean, there's a wide array of examples from a lot of time. Initially, I was helping people only with sexual addiction, and then it spread to wives and betrayal trauma and PTSD and chronic pain and a whole stuff. So in the book, there's a lot of examples to try and cover a whole wide range of territory. In toward the end, I tell the story of Quincy. Quincy is a beautiful young Southern belle. She and her husband, I just barely was visiting them just this last summer, just absolutely incredible people, big-hearted, open-hearted. She had come to one of our intensive retreats. But she showed up with this like really chipper attitude and wanting to include everyone and always be happy. And her story was this sort of fairy tale story, met her husband in high school and they love each other. And so I was like, why is she here? But she struggled with depression a little bit, she said. And so we were going through some of the experiences that I take people through step by step in this place. We're having them relate what's really going on. We're starting to dig into how they move and the way they breathe and how they use their voice and basically introducing them to their body. At a certain point, I'm doing some of this deep tissue release where I'm helping people pinpoint where their thoughts and emotions are kind of like linked to their body tensions and stuff. So I go through this process and she's breathing as best she can. She's relaxing her system. She's doing a beautiful job. After that, she gets up, she goes to the bathroom, and in that place, she just looks in the mirror and her whole world shifts. And all of a sudden, like 20 years worth of memories that she had forgotten show up of a time when she was raped as a young girl, when at her friend's house. It was her friend's brother. He had shaken her awake in the middle of the night at a sleepover and she thought it was her fault because she didn't say no, but who says no when you're just roughly awoken at night? That turned into her feeling horrible about herself in this deeply Christian environment, like she had committed some egregious sin. So she started treating herself really poorly. She ended up with bulimia at times, and then anorexia at other times. And then she, like, a lot of body image issues. She ended up being like the target for a lot of these men to come and like pull their pants down in front of her. Like, she ended up having to get removed from school because she was overwhelmed by it, all fueled by this initial place of, I have this rape, and I grew up in an environment where her parents did the best they could, but she had the feeling like if she doesn't measure up or if they're upset, it's her fault. So in that, she'd carried that 20 years worth of memories that she had completely blocked out. Wow. And all of it floods back right there. And she's sitting there in the bathroom. At that moment, she's just, tears are coming. And then in the middle of it, she remembers something that I'd taught her right there in the retreat about how to take those memories and start to kind of clear them out so that you no longer are emotionally tied to them. So she goes from absolute abject crying into total laughter, belly laughs, huge guffaws of like, holy cow, I didn't realize it was. And then everything from that point in time started to change in her life in some huge ways. Not from sitting in a therapist's office and talking about it. Not from even know, she wouldn't even know what to talk about. It was all nonverbal stuff.
Right.
We start to pinpoint where her body is stuck. And nowadays, because they haven't found a database in the brain of where memory lives, now they're talking about maybe memory is in all the fascia and the connective tissues and the little deep impressions that have been made over time of tension and strain and stuff. And maybe that's what the brain is relying on for memory. We moved those. We shifted those around, and now all of her sense of self gets shaken up. She starts to realize, I am not what's happened to me.
There you go.
The car is not the road construction it drove through. She starts to have this space open up, and now then she texts me periodically, just like she's looking at flowers and trees, and She's like, I never was able to enjoy life, or I used to be afraid of going outside. And all these things changed from handling breathing, movement, tension. And yes, we do have to talk about the memories and stuff from time to time. But it's so much easier to do that when you're dealing with the whole picture. So that was Quincy, you know, and that was rape, trauma, eating disorders, all the stuff.
Wow. Folks, the book is Built for Freedom. Bob also hosts the podcast Alive and Free. And unfortunately, we have run out of time. But Bob, real quickly, I know that you also do some retreats. So if anybody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
All the things that I have, you can get a digital copy of the book, I think for like $5 on my website. You can find the Alive and Free podcast there. You can find some basic online programs and access to the retreats, a chance to schedule a call with my team, all at thefreedomspecialist.com.
All right. And for everybody out there, if you're driving and you can't write that down, we will make sure that you can get that on our site at answers.network. Bob, thank you so much for coming on. I'd love to have you back. I think there's so much more we could go into. But again, just thank you for being someone who's making a positive difference in the world for many people.
Oh, it's a joy for me. So you're welcome.
All right. For everybody out there, please visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network, or just subscribe to the show. You can do it through Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube, Rumble, Spreaker, BeatChute, OogeTube, and many other popular podcasts. You know, I've been spoken to. I've been told that I'm by supposed experts that to expand my audience, that it's been suggested to me that I create more controversy to get interviews, to come up with something that's just really edgy, and I don't know that that's me. So in fact, and one of the things, cause I said, well, you know, I thought that I was bringing a lot of things that are really good, and they go, it doesn't matter if it's good or bad. Well, that doesn't seem authentic to me. But if I'm to get higher profile guests, I'm told I need to get more comments, reviews, and listeners. So without a bunch of radical sound bites or anything else, I ask you, please leave a comment or review. And the next time you're on Facebook, Twitter, which is now X, or Instagram, stop by our page, check out some of our latest shows. And if you like them, like us and just spread the word. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.